Welcome to The Jewish Diasporist, a podcast exploring the political, social, and cultural implications of life in diaspora. I am one of your hosts, Ben Yanowitz. This week we have a very special guest host,
Rabbi Chel Mandel.
Chel, can you tell us a little bit about what this conversation and episode is?
We did a live recording at a space called Sabrosa in Santa Cruz, California, with DJ Chaya and myself about Jewish community formation and the evolution of what is happening or what we see as happening as trends and transformation at this time.
What do you think is the significance of having this conversation with DJ Chaya, as of course also with this beautiful performance that she gave?
I was really excited to talk to her because what she's doing in bringing culture and creating Jewish space with the intersection of, you know, Yiddish song, archival material, and bringing that to audiences of all ages, and also as an entry point for younger Jews, mixing it with electronic music, just invites in a whole other group of people, an entry point with meaning beyond Shabbat spaces and Jewish practice spaces. Is a different take and entry point.
Could you tell us a little bit about the specific space of Sabrosa and the overall organizing of this event?
Yeah, Sabrosa is an anarchist space with a whole history that one I'm sure could look up, and a community member of Tzimtzum community, a Jewish community member who also is a member of Sabrosa, and a few of our community members are members of Sabrosa anarchist space. One of them came to me with the idea of, like, we need to bring DJ Chaya and she should play at the anarchist space. And I was like, great, she's already on my list of people to bring in because I think what she's doing is really radical and beautiful and just really important to bring in this history and spirituality and, like, oh, it's just such a beautiful intersection. And so we were like, okay, we have to bring her in. So that's how we brought her.
I don't know if it was said during the conversation, but I remember she told us that she came just the previous day from, I don't remember if it was Klez, California, a Klezmer festival up in Berkeley. And I thought it was really beautiful to have her come from this big festival to a much more intimate gathering with Tzimtzum. What do you think is the significance of this sort of event, particularly in relation to Tzimtzum and the overall vision for what the Tzimtzum community is building?
Yeah, our community is really interested in how we live as Jews of the diaspora. And, like, what does that mean? And how do we engage with our Judaism beyond Israel needing to have an allegiance or alliance to that place? And what does it look like to reclaim our Judaism where we live here in Santa Cruz, California, and take traditions of the past and look at them and analyze them and see what works for us? And how do we connect with lineage with where we are here now? So, you know, looking at her music and what she's doing does that. And I think it does it with real research and kavod, like honor. Mm-hmm. It's not just something, you know, quick that she's thrown together. She clearly has researched and spent time in these spaces and grown up with mentors. And it's like real depth. And I feel like in Tzimtzum, we want to renew and create, co-create new tradition, but also holding on with deep reverence and care to what's come before us. So I feel like Chaya does that. So that fits with what we're trying to do here. And also to mention, you know, she's like queering. She's queering this Jewish space that she's creating, and we are as well.
Yeah, what really struck me during the performance is the way that she brought in not only these, like, recordings from Yiddish archives and conversations with her mentors and her ancestors, but also, like, she brought in a little lesson about Yiddish dance that, for me, actually, like, I'm not so much comfortable dancing around people. I don't really feel super comfortable doing that. But I felt like in this grounding, I was able to genuinely feel more comfortable dancing really in close proximity with people than I ever have before. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, I'm not sure if that has to do with the fact that she framed it around, like, this is what Yiddish dancing is, or if it was just, like, the genuinely really beautiful atmosphere that the event created.
Yeah, it was a really, really rich and powerful space, the way she can storytell and layer that over the sounds, the beats, the background music, and also the embodiment of dance, of call and response in Yiddish, and just the multimodalities for one to enter into this space. It was all-encompassing and radical. And I think looking at the Bund and history there and, like, pulling from histories that aren't always told or that are on the margins or are forgotten. And that's so, so important to what we're doing here at Tsum-Tsum too, is what is the past and how do we relate to it and how do we bring that forth? There's a lot to learn of our histories.
Yeah. I mean, what really struck me about the performance, which we unfortunately weren't able to record, you just got this conversation between Rabbi Chell and DJ Chaya that you're about to hear. What really struck me about the performance is the way that she interspersed teaching within it.
And really, there's something for any moment. There's something for loving the ancestors, there's something for hating the ancestors. And this is a song for hating the ancestors. It's called Shelton Shelton Tog Kumen the Boyle, obviously. Which means, cursed be the day I was born. Can everyone just say that?
Cursed be the day I was born!
Because, the song says, when I was younger, I didn't know any love. I didn't inherit any love. And now that I'm older, I've healed that within me. I've surrounded myself by love. But I don't feel healed.
She used the music as this modality of education, but also she framed everything in a way of like, oh, this is why this song has meaning to me and it connects to these lineages. And also like bringing in songs like Oi Ir Narishe Tsionisten, which is, oh, you foolish little Zionist. And not only teaching that song to all of us, but educating us on its history, connection to the Bund, that I think for many people, that's the first time they even have any exposure to these ideas. Is there anything else you want to say about this event and what it means to us?
You know, Tsum-Tsum is in still its early stages of community formation. I mean, we've been doing this for 4 years, but really the last 2 years we've taken off in terms of organizing and bringing community together. And, you know, we're in a place of, you know, we do Shabbats monthly, we do the High Holy Days, we gather for ritual and life cycle and all the things that, you know, a synagogue would do. We're not a synagogue, we're a community. And we're really working to bring in movers, shakers, thinkers, academics, dreamers of the Jewish community who are making waves and thinking about what Jewish life is beyond the walls of the formal institutions. And so it's really special for us to have Chaya, and soon we'll have Hadar Cohen, and we'll have Julie Weitz. And these are people who are thinking beyond Zionism. And they're also thinking beyond what's been handed to us in this like very, in my opinion, often narrow framework of, yeah, Jewish community spaces. So this was like a really cool opportunity with a good turnout. And yeah, we just like really appreciate that and want to bring in more people doing Jewish community gathering and work beyond the religious, which we also do, but we want to expand what Jewish community looks like.
Yeah, no, I think it was a really beautiful event, and I'm so grateful for DJ Chaya, not only for coming to our community, but also being willing to, and honestly, more than willing, excited to make this into an episode, a special episode of the Jewish Diasporas podcast. And I'm so grateful. I say this every time. We are so lucky to have you, Chell, here in Santa Cruz.
Thank you.
Every community needs a radical rabbi. It's how we are going to bring about the world to come. Really want to take this opportunity to really think about what we need to be building. We're about to be entering the high holiday season. This is a time not only for introspection, teshuvah, which is renewal, return, but also of tzedakah, charity and giving. Of course, you need to be giving to those that are obviously most impacted by the genocide in Gaza and across Palestine. But also, please remember that the Jewish community on the margins, things like the Tsum-Tsum community, things like DJ Chaya and Klezstronica, these communities don't have the support that the JCCs and the Jewish Federation have. So please consider, even from afar, you can make donations to the Tsum-Tsum community, you can make donations to support DJ Chaya's work. And of course, you could also consider making a donation to the Jewish Diasporas podcast or our Patreon. All of those links will be in the description. Without any further ado, we hope you enjoy this beautiful conversation between DJ Chaya and Rabbi Chell Mandel.
HIS-verse podcast, live from Sabrosa in Santa Cruz. I'm going to start asking you questions.
Wait, you can start.
We talked about this. Go ahead.
Can you just introduce yourself really quickly and say your name and what are some important aspects of your life right now?
My name is Rabbi Chel Mandel. I use they, them pronouns. I've helped run the Seem Soom community. This is actually going into our fourth year. And if you look at the anti-Zionist and non-Zionist spaces in California, there's maybe like four explicit like Jewish communities. And so that's what I'm doing here. And then to actually pay the bills, I work at the University of San Francisco. It's very fun. Okay, Chaya, tell us about you.
My name is Chaya and I live in New York and I'm here on tour. I'm a musician. My music samples from Yiddish archives around the world. Yiddish is the language of Jews of Eastern Europe, also sort of a name for the culture of Jews of Eastern Europe. And I work with archival repositories, so institutions, buildings, storehouses that store recordings, audio recordings of Yiddish culture. And then I make electronic music out of them, mostly focusing in techno traditions. Yeah, and focusing on liberation ecologies, so materials that focus on Jewish anti-Zionism, Yiddish anarchism, and other folk songs that urge us to consider each other as human beings.
That's so cool. It's so cool you're here. I think you really fit this space and the vibe and this crowd. Okay, cool. Go ahead.
So I think we're going to start by talking a little bit about both of our communities and the way that we think about communities. We're obviously in the minority as anti-Zionist Jews and people who are working on bringing people into anti-Zionist spaces. And I think we're going to talk a little bit about what that means to each of us and how that differs and how the people that we meet differ a little bit and how our relationship to them differs. So I wanted to ask you, who are the people in your community and what does it mean for you to be, I know that you've called yourself Big Tent.
Okay, I want to clarify because I'm Big Tent. I could be out in the world and be practically
well, what is Big Tent?
Okay, thanks. What is Big Tent? There's like this idea in Jewish space that there's like Big Tent, we welcome Jews of all backgrounds. But actually, after October 7th, our tent got smaller. And I'm okay with that. I feel very clear about that. I think our community does of like, we're actually an anti-Zionist community. If you can get with that, come be with us, come learn with us, come engage with us. I myself don't mind being in and out of different spaces that are bigger tent, but somebody had talked to me after October 7th and reminded me, hey, like 99% of Jewish spaces and institutions are Zionist. We need a space that is not, and that's explicit. And so that was like, oh, obviously. So we're not that Big Tent. If you want to come and be in the anti-Zionist spirit and learn and engage and do that, you can come be with us. So we're actually a bit of a smaller tent. But I do love a lot of people with different opinions and politics. But our community is, we picked a lane and kind of over those Jewish spaces that don't pick lanes.
Yeah.
Yeah. So
I really agree with that.
So tell me about your work then and how that engages with that.
And I think I also, I work with a lot of, so I'm, you're sort of your own institution or you're working within Seem Soom, which is its own institution. And for me, I work a lot with other institutions. So I play for Jewish festivals and synagogues and in Jewish community spaces. And I work with a lot of institutions that would call themselves Big Tent, which means to them basically accepting of anti-Zionist and Zionist thoughts or modalities, and my role within these institutions is to push them more towards an anti-Zionist modality, or at least highlight for them the ways, the anti-Zionist histories of the materials that they are trying to prioritize. So that if that's a Yiddish institution, it means highlighting explicitly within the space Yiddish historically anti-Zionist materials that are rooted in histories that the institution is seeking to uplift. And also working with community organizers on the ground in the different cities that I tour in to make sure that the narratives that I'm pushing within these spaces are in line with the organizing goals. So if people are having a boycott of the space or trouble with the space, I work within the structure of the people organizing the boycott to make sure that I'm really pushing the institution where they want it to go. And not inviting people needlessly into an institution that's being boycotted, or at all, in many cases.
I have so much to say, we could be here all night, but no, keep going, this is good.
So, I wanted to ask...
Feel free to grab chairs from outside and come in, they're out there.
We talked a little bit about how we relate to Jewish institutions and Jewish narratives about what it means to be an institution, and I wanted to ask you how you relate to Judaism itself, and particularly to Jewish history within your space, and how you define your space through that history.
That's a good question. Through Jewish history.
Like, what are the things in the past that you feel inspired by, and what is the ways in which you're rooted in that past or in conflict with that
past?
Yeah.
No, I mean, just for me, and like, my history of working in Jewish day schools and synagogues, and there's some stuff that really works, that's great, and there's a lot that really doesn't. So I tried to pull the things over the last 13 years that I've learned to bring into the space, but I have to keep catching myself because I'm an institutional Jew. I come from the institution, so I keep doing things the way that it's been done. So what helps me is this community, because actually a lot of the people who come to Tzimtzum are not Jews who grew up in institutional space. And so like our whole leadership team, except one person, didn't grow up in Jewish community. And so they get to bring in ideas and ways of doing things that I couldn't even conceive of. So when I think about history, I actually just think about like the last decade of learning. I did my rabbinic internship in a place, it was a synagogue without walls. And just that in itself, the idea that we don't need a building, just, it's so simple and, you know, but I feel like I just pull from the projects that are happening around me. And actually, like, I think the most important thing for me is to be out in the Jewish world and not in Santa Cruz. Because I notice in Santa Cruz what happens is, like, we get stuck here and our ideas become stagnant. And that's how I felt about the Jewish spaces here. Like, have you left the synagogue in 30 years? Actually, it's important when I go to New York and LA and the Bay, I go to every synagogue, I go to any Jewish event I can to meet and engage and be like, what's happening? What's the cutting edge thing? So I actually pull from all the things happening. I don't want to get like stagnant in this space.
What is happening?
I mean, there's so many awesome radical movements and things going on. I mean, like the way in which one can access their Judaism, it's just... we've really broken open the idea that it needs to happen within the walls of a synagogue. It's just, even with what you're doing, I was excited that you're coming, because even just through your music, I would argue now this is a Jewish spiritual experience. And one of my students at USF listened to your music, and he was like, that was pretty cool, I actually really liked it. And he's like, I don't really connect with my Judaism, but that was pretty cool. And I feel like that's the mentality. I think that's happening more and more, that it's not just about prayer and going to services, which I love. I mean, I'm a sucker for prayer and services. But that like Judaism can live in the cultural realm and in the community realm. I don't know if it's more than it has, but just like Gen Z and millennials are like eating it up on the left. I feel like there's so many cool projects and things emerging. The last thing I'll say is we applied for the Jewish Liberation Fund grant. It's like the only... they're delayed by a month and a half because they got over 200 applications for like radical leftist Jewish projects that are anti-Zionist. Like that's a big deal and that's really, really cool. And I was reviewing and looking at the names of the projects and I was like, dang, there's so many cool things happening. And I had this moment where I was like, if we don't get the money, there's so many good things that deserve this money. Like that's so cool. I don't know, that didn't exist 10 years ago when I entered this realm.
Do you see yourself in community with any Jewish lineages or Jewish sects, denominations of Judaism, or any sort of movements that are historically present or happening today?
Yeah, I I really don't like denominational Judaism. I think it's served a purpose and it still does, but it just does not work for me. It doesn't work, I don't think, for our community, because denominational Judaism asks us to buy into particular ideas of a denomination, reform, conservative. When I'm like, wow, there's things I love from all these different denominations. I got my ordination as a non-denominational rabbi, and it's cool because my goal in my rabbinate is to transcend the barriers. And why would I, like, I have to go agree with the reform movement to be a reform rabbi? No way. The reform movement is behind the times. Yeah, like, really. I realized, I think it was actually around Israel. When I was looking at rabbinical schools, I was like, oh, I have to be a Zionist to go to any of these rabbinical schools, and these denominations aren't going to hire me. And so I got a non-denominational ordination. And so that's what our community is. And I love, like, Hasidic text. I like to, like, sing and dance. Like, we pull from renewal, from conservative, I mean, everything. Like, the kitchen in San Francisco was where I did my learning, and I liked it because it's, like, egalitarian, traditional, but Rabbi Noah would always talk about style. She said it's about the style you bring. So it's like, I myself am a little more conservative maybe than our community, but at the end of the day, it's like, what's the aesthetic and style in which we bring? It's like its own thing. I can't really, like, root it in one thing because it really pulls from all. You should come to a Shabbat and then maybe you'll see, you know? But how about you? Can you tell us about tell us about your music and, like, the lineage?
Yeah, I totally agree with you that we should pull from all these different things and just make it our own, because there's no set list of things that's going to work for everyone, of course. And I think that each person is really doing that, whether you know it or not, whether you're ultra-Orthodox and you think that maybe you're practicing this in a holistic way where you're practicing all the commandments of Judaism, but actually there's thousands of laws and little practices of Judaism, so no one person is doing them all. Everyone is pulling from different things. And I think for me, it's really important to me to make it explicit what I'm pulling from where and when. Because not only because I feel like it respects the people who originated those lineages or helped carry them forward, but I also feel like it helps me understand them really deeply. Because if I know that I'm pulling from Reconstructionist, so I hear a lot of what you're saying reminds me of Reconstructionist Judaism, this idea of Judaism as civilization, like this holistic culture with all these different practices. And that idea is so beautiful from Reconstructionist Judaism. And I think that's basically what I'm gonna present tonight, is this idea of what does it mean to live an Eastern European Jewish life that is full, that is spiritual and non-spiritual and practice-based and emotional and all these different things. So that's an idea from there, and I think that that's really beautiful, but I want to know, but then I want to read that book, Judaism as Civilization, and I want to learn all the intricacies of that and learn which intricacies I want and which I don't. And I think when we know the places that each of the things we're pulling from come from, the world is so open to us in infinite complexity.
Yeah. I mean, like, in my training, every week we switch off between the Reform Siddur and the Korean Modern Orthodox Siddur. So that's, like, the stuff that I come from, is pulling from the denominations. I have a lot of kavod and honor for them, but it's not really, like, one lane. I feel like it's really, like, bits and pieces. Like, the rabbis I studied with are Orthodox, Reconstructionist, renewal, all of the things. Yeah, I think it is really, really important to name and root ourselves.
I want to ask just one question, because
this is the podcast.
This is also a live episode of the Jewish Diasporas podcast. And the question I want to ask is really the question we ask at the very start of every podcast, which is, Chaya, what brings you to doing the work that you're doing? What brought you to explore Yiddish archival music and then decide to make electronica and really new wave music? What really brought you to that kind of synthesis of interests?
They're really just things I picked up along the way. I mean, growing up, I grew up in a Jewish household. My dad's a Jewish studies teacher. He brought all these Jewish thinkers into our house, and I learned about all these different Jewish traditions and ways of being Jewish. And the one that resonated most with me, partly because of the music, was Yiddish and Yiddish culture, and I think the thing that resonated with me most about it was the fact that it is this kind of holistic approach to life, that it is the culture of my grandparents, the clothes that they wore, or my great-grandparents, the clothes that they wore, the language that they spoke, the ancestral magic. There's a lot of magic in Yiddish culture and superstitions and beautiful things, and beautiful folk songs and music. And I ended up going to school to study this music. And at the same time, or when I was also a kid, I heard a synthesizer on the radio, and I was like, I want to learn how to play that instrument. And eventually started going to all these underground raves when I was in college, that really reminded me of this Yiddish culture and Yiddish background, not only in the dance styles, the kind of social dance styles, but also in the ways in which the people who were making that music, which is Black American music, were thinking about their cultural history and being very similar to my teachers at school who were teaching me Yiddish music. And I felt like there were so many opportunities in techno music, because of the lineage of that music, to explicitly incorporate radicalism in a way that the Yiddish community today could really learn from. And I felt that this music had a liberatory potential for my community and a political potential for my community, and that by combining them, I could really sway the Yiddish world in the direction that I wanted it to go in, which was sort of this anarchist, anti-Zionist, radical direction.
In the radical anarchist direction, can you still experience God in your music? Is it spiritual?
Most people would say no. The Yiddish anarchist and labor movement history is one that is really tied to Marxism and really tied to this idea that religion is the opiate of the masses. Mm-hmm. And therefore, a lot of the core institutions that came forward with these ideas at the turn of the century, in the early 1900s, were very strongly anti-religious. Mm-hmm. I grew up more or less religious. I went to Jewish day school, sort of conservadox, and I really connected with it. My dad is a teacher of Jewish mysticism, Kabbalah, Zohar, which is sort of this tradition that is very aesthetically oriented in its mysticism. There's gods and goddesses and dragons flying through the sky, and you walk into the cave, and then there's a burning book, and then you read the book, and then the book bursts into flames, and the cave bursts into flames, and then you forget all the knowledge that's in the book. And it's like these crazy, I grew up with these crazy magical images were such a core part of my Judaism and were deeply spiritual for me. And I think entering the secular Yiddish world, I encountered a lot of, I was often the only one in the room who had that experience, that religious experience. And I still work very closely with institutions who are rooted in this strongly secular tradition. But as someone who grew up with a religious tradition, I see it as sort of my contribution to bring in this spiritual, mystical lens into this music and actually to challenge some of these ideas within the music. I study and I work with the material very much of this organization called the Jewish Labor Bund, which was the biggest Jewish organization in 1905, an Eastern European socialist Jewish organization that has lived on till today. You can get involved with it by talking to Ben. And it's, amazingly radical socialist, very, very strictly secular. And I've been pairing Bund recordings with more religious takes on the same materials in order to emphasize that through these materials, we can also breathe these spiritual traditions, and also to highlight the traditions existing contemporary to the Bund, so in 1905, that were more religiously inclined, like the religious Yiddish anarchists, who believed that basically, if there was a divine power, then there could be no hierarchy on earth.
Cool. That's like the most radical thing, is to be able to be between both, I think.
Yeah. And to bring...
Yeah, well, I mean, maybe you don't have to agree with me.
The most radical thing.
No, I think that in Jewish space, like, those are usually very, very separate.
And to be able to bring your whole self into every space. Yeah. That's what I think about mostly, because we're all compositions of our whole life experiences, and this is just one way. I think that the thing that I urge everyone who comes to my shows is to look into your past and traditions and find the hundreds of thousands of millions of multitudes that are there, because there's going to be something that you like and that you want. And even if a lot of things are very painful, there's going to be some tiny thread that is so beautiful to you and that resonates so deeply with your core as a person. And if you pull that thread, it will have infinite knowledge at the other end. Now you go. Wait, what's the question again?
You came up with the question. These are your questions.
No, Ben just asked the question.
The question was essentially, what brought you to decide to make this music with the Yiddish?
No, for Chell. Oh.
What's your question, Ben?
Isn't that the same question?
Well, that was the same question. My question for Chell, I guess it would be, how do you bring in, because Tsim Tsum is effectively primarily a ritual space. Tsim Tsum brings people together for Shabbat, for holidays, for other lifetime events. How do you hold that space for the secular side of things as well?
I mean, we just, 3 weeks ago, to whatever it was, I don't know what time is anymore, I'm in High Holy Day time. We had 12 people in my living room, my dining room, planning for the High Holy Days, and then in the backyard was another 12 people preparing to go to an action in San Francisco with Jewish Voice for Peace to sit in the senator's office to tell them to stop sending weapons to Israel. So like that literally happened behind a wall, like in my home. So the idea that Tsim Tsum is in partnership and is in coalition, is in community with a bunch of secular Jews, some here tonight, who engage in political action or are just not interested in Shabbat. But I think what's actually radical and really cool is, like, even after that action, a few people who don't usually come to Tsim Tsum, I said, come on Shabbat, like, let's gather after the action a few days later. And a lot of people were at Shabbat, and that was really radical. I'm like, cool. So you haven't really been in the Jewish spiritual space, but you're in the political space. Like, I'm interested in creating crossover, and that we don't have to just be in one space and that we can move around the spaces. So I'll also just say a lot of people who come to Tsim Tsum are coming to their Judaism for the first time. So many people have whispered to me in the first few years, I said, okay, I'm like only Jewish. I only have one parent. I'm like, I don't care. Just like, let's go. And they're like, oh, I'm coming to this for the first time. Or people who are coming in saying, the other thing I got whispered to me the first few years was, I'm not an Israel person. Is that okay? And I'm like, yeah, no, me neither. Come on. Like, so a lot of people, and we have a handful of people who are on the path of conversion who come to Tsim Tsum. So you asked about the secular and how we bridge it, but actually I think a lot of people in Santa Cruz, my experience, have been Jews identify as being secular, and actually we've created spiritual space to say, it's not so bad, come try it. And I think a lot of our community, like having these kinds of events, having Hadar Cohen come and talk about politics, like to try and mix it up and have different events and ways into one's Judaism beyond Shabbat and ritual space. Also, we did the mikvah yesterday morning at 6 a.m. at the ocean, water immersion. There were people there that I've never seen before. And they're like, I haven't done anything religious or spiritual. This is like my first thing. I'm like, great, this is a wonderful first thing. But I think it's really creating an entry point for Jews.
It's so beautiful to hear you talk about how people make meaning in your space. And you live such an intensely Jewish life that so it almost sounds, when you talk about it, like there was sort of no that you just, you couldn't do anything else. I mean, it seems so beautiful and fully encompassing, and I'm wondering what brought you to that and why you chose to orient your life in this way.
Things choose you. You don't choose them sometimes. I kept trying to not become a rabbi. Like, who would want to become a rabbi? Like, you go to school for 5 years, it costs a lot of money. I knew it with my politics, I wouldn't get hired, in a synagogue that would pay me well. But I just really care about Judaism. I care about the future of it. And I think I realized, like, oh, I can do this. Just like, this feels natural for me in this position. And I love creating spaces. I love creating new paradigms and playing. I love play. And I feel like it's just in my bones, honestly, at the end of the day. I thought, if I'm going to live here and surf, then I have to be in Jewish space. So they started with little in-home Shabbats, and then they grew, and this has grown and grown and grown. This year we're already at double the amount of High Holy Day tickets sold, and we're still a week out, which I intend for that to double. So it's just like, it just happened. I don't know. Divine intervention? I'm just a dedicated Gemini. You know what it is to be a dedicated Gemini, you know?
I don't know how dedicated am I. I'm a Gemini.
Yeah, we're supposed to be Geminis.
Should we open it up for questions?
Yeah, and then we can listen to you.
Music.
Any questions?
Is Yiddishkeit coming back?
I've been teaching all weekend at this festival called Klez California that everyone should go to next year. It's amazing weekend of Yiddish music and culture. And I feel like as a teacher, I'm always jumping between topics. And I saw my friend Avia teach a dance class, and she didn't jump around at all. She just kept going in a straight line. And I was like, how does one do that? And my friend was like, maybe don't have ADHD. So Yiddishkeit is... it translates literally to Jewishness, and it's this idea about living in Eastern European Jewish culture, Yiddishkeit, practicing culture. I think that's how I would translate it, more or less. And there's a bigger history to this, so Yiddishkeit used to be this thing that was just obvious. Jews, for the most part, the majority of Jews lived in Eastern Europe by the year 1900, with, you know, many beautiful flourishing communities in other places. And for the Jews of Eastern Europe, Yiddishkeit was just sort of obvious, partly because in many instances they were forced to live separately from their co-territorial neighbors, and practiced music and practiced culture and channeled both ancestral wisdom and also made a lot of new stuff and were very influenced by people they lived around in Eastern Europe, co-territorial communities. And then a couple things happened. So there was a period of enlightenment where a lot of Jews of Eastern Europe became secular and assimilated a lot into the broader culture. And then after that, there was, many forced displacements, many moving around, many people assimilated that way or left. After that, there was the big rise of the Zionist movement, which eventually would overshadow an organization like the Bund and became the dominant strain of thought in Jewish life by the mid-1900s. And the Zionist movement posited that Jews should be unified under one nationalist banner. So all the Jews of the world should all speak one language and practice one culture, and that we could take all these disparate communities living around the world that were all speaking different languages and practicing different music and different culture and unify that culture into one homogenous culture that would be in Israel. And then after that, the Holocaust killed 6 million Jews of Eastern Europe and many other people, and a lot of Yiddish culture was lost and forcibly stamped out, and the people who were not murdered were deeply traumatized and ashamed of the culture. And I think all of these factors combined together to create a real loss of the culture, especially my work focuses a lot on the Zionist movement's impact on this. People said, okay, we're done with this. This is the language of the past. We're going to speak Hebrew now. And they threw out their Yiddish books onto the streets. In Israel, Yiddish was made illegal in the founding, after the founding, or slightly before the founding of the state, and you weren't allowed to do Yiddish plays in theaters, and people were beaten up on the street for speaking Yiddish. And in America, Yiddish and Yiddish pronunciation was taken out of the schools. I'll do a little bit of that, or show a little bit of that tonight through the music. And Yiddish pronunciation was taken out of prayer spaces, and people were bullied for speaking Yiddish. And yeah, people threw their books, they threw their records out onto the street. And there was this idea that we're done with this by the 1950s. But this didn't stop everyone. A lot of people kept speaking the language. This man, Aaron Lansky, went around with a giant truck and he picked up everyone's books off the street. And Theodore Bekel, a Yiddish singer, kept recording song after song of Yiddish songs, even though his record label said, don't do that anymore. And people kept performing plays and writing Yiddish books. But largely, it fell out of fashion. And then, in the 70s, a group of hippies, Jewish hippies, were playing a bunch of bluegrass music and were told, go away, play the music of your own culture. And they went and they started learning Yiddish music, Yiddish music that had been tucked into the attics of their grandparents, that had been left only to the memories of a few old people who were very reluctant to teach them, and was basically very, very diminished in the mainstream culture. And they started this thing called the Klezmer Revival, Klezmer being the music of Jews of Eastern Europe, and started bands. The most well-known is the Klezmatics, but all these Klezmer Revival bands. And shortly on their heels came many similar people. These people were, a lot of them were queer, a lot of them were leftists, people on the outskirts of Jewish society who couldn't find a home but within the mainstream Zionist framework. And yeah, had this big revival of Yiddish language, culture, and music with the previous generation, bringing the music down from their attics, bringing these older musicians out of retirement and back onto worldwide stages. And it created just this blooming of culture, 70s, 80s, really, 90s. And then there are people like me. I'm the next generation after that. And so we call ourselves the second generation of the Klezmer Revival, and our mentors are the people who dug the music out of their grandparents' attics. And that's weird. That's a weird position to be in, because it's a revival music, but now it's sort of its own thing. Is it an unbroken lineage? Is it a completely new thing? Is it a new thing since the 80s? Is it a new thing since now? When does the line break? When does the line start? More and more young Jews are becoming disillusioned with Zionism, especially after the Lebanon War in the 80s, but more and more now, and now with this ongoing genocide, people are leaving the Zionist movement in droves.
Right.
Yeah. And people are looking for a place to be rooted and a place to still be proud of where they're from and who they are and who their grandparents were. And that's not an easy thing for a lot of people. And I'm very happy that people are finding Yiddish, that descendants of Yiddish speakers are finding Yiddish, that other people who are not descendants of Yiddish speakers are finding meaning in this culture, and especially meaning in the sort of Marxist anarchist tradition that was so big. But I said this before, but it's worth saying again and again, the Bund was the biggest Jewish organization in the world in 1905. It was a Marxist organization. It was a strongly anti-Zionist organization. It was an organization that believed that Jewish safety was deeply interwoven with the workers' movement, with the women's movement, with the anti-police movement in Tsarist Russia. And this was so big. It came with its own set of customs, of folk songs, of ways of organizing. It was really brought a whole generation of Yiddish culture to the forefront of Jewish life. And we live with the legacy of this culture, books and books and recordings of this material. I'm currently working with the YIVO Institute for Jewish Research in New York to digitize 750 hours of cassette tapes of recordings of meetings of the Bund. It's a huge treasury legacy of this organization. And we have all of that to work with. And we have growing numbers now that so many, sorry, you asked a very complicated question.
It was on purpose.
So many people are leaving the Zionist movement and coming to this movement. And there are people really looking for this stuff and wanting it. And there's a real need for it now as we see, hopefully, the decline of the Israeli state machine and the separation of Jewish culture from this very harmful, genocidal, racist, horrible movement. The Bundists, they kept going. They didn't stop after the Holocaust. When I first started learning about Bund history, all these people would say, oh yeah, the Bundists were great, but then the Holocaust proved them wrong because it didn't keep us safe. It didn't work out for us. But no, the Bundists, I'm listening to these recordings of the Bundists speaking in the 50s and the 60s, and they're saying the Holocaust shows us that we were right. The Holocaust shows us that this is what fascism can do, that this is what nationalism can do. If it can do it to us, it can do it to anyone. And that's an important lesson for now. And I think Yiddishkeit, is it back? Did it ever leave? I don't know. But what is true is that we're currently in the second generation of a revival movement, and that means that it's its own culture. And we've had all this time since the 70s to make institutions for this thing, to make klezmer festivals like Klez California, like Yiddish New York in New York, Klez Canada in Canada, Yiddish Summer Weimar, everywhere there's Yiddish festivals, Klezmor in Vienna, there, just the, around the world, all these Yiddish, amazing Yiddish festivals and language and culture and institutions that are embracing Yiddish under a bigger umbrella, like the Jewish Diasporist and podcast, which is the podcast that we're recording right now. It's crazy. and it's time for us to keep doing that project, whether you're from a Yiddish background or not, truly. To keep doing the project of reviving the most radical forms of our ancestral traditions, because they're worth preserving. And there's something worth preserving in any tradition. Yes?
Hi, I'm 82 now. And when I was about 12 or 13, this back in the 50s, we had an underground, because we met in a basement, Kinderschule, taught by blacklisted Jewish folk singers, Yiddish folk singers. Like, I remember the first day, we all learned how to say, Ich bin do, you know, so that's my first line in Yiddish. But I still remember, this is during the McCarthy period, there were like 200 of us from all over LA, and we performed all these Yiddish socialist songs at the only place in LA that would let us sing publicly, the Embassy Auditorium, I think it was called the Embassy, singing songs like Zot they came last Geisten lesson, like the song of the Warsaw Ghetto. And I was like 11, 12 years old. Okay? So that was a memory when you said all this. That was kind of a Yiddish underground during the McCarthy period.
Wow.
In LA. Yay, LA!
Yeah. That's another element of the 50s that I didn't touch on. My dad went to the Yeshiva of Flatbush, which is an Orthodox day school in Brooklyn, and there was a group in the early 60s. There was a group of Yiddishists there, but they called them the Yiddish crazies, and they bullied them. But that's just to say that in every institution and all around all of these spaces, there were these underground meetings of people who knew what was really up, and that's in many ways an unbroken lineage. Truly. And these institutions are still around. The Bund is still around. It's having a big revival right now. There's an argument to be said that that is an unbroken lineage. The Workers' Circle still has a building. Still has a building in LA. If anyone's in LA and is interested in like helping buildings stay buildings and not get demolished, go to the worker circle and help them keep that building alive, because it's amazing. They still have their building. It's really, really old. It's incredible. I'm trying to think of other unbroken lineages of Yiddish. Camp Kinderland is an amazing Yiddish socialist camp in New York that still has hundreds and hundreds of kids there every summer.
Not to mention the Bund in Melbourne, where the only pre-1939 branch has been functioning ever since.
The Bund in Melbourne.
Shout out.
Pre-1939. Yeah. And so I think these institutions and people who carry these lineages are really worth seeking out, because there's so much beautiful complexities and so much more to learn than creating something totally new. There's something to be said for creating something totally new, but I think that with the older institutions, you just inherit so much complexity and multitudes more than any one person could make on their own.
Do you want to hear music?
Yeah.
Wait, but I want one more. You want
one more question? Okay, one more. Eden.
Yeah, Eden.
I was wondering.
This is great.
I like the questions.
Well, thank you. Thank you for being here. I was wondering what sort of reactions you've gotten, especially from older generations, when they hear your music, they hear electronic sounds and Yiddish. This is kind of under the assumption that older folks are not listening to electronic music, but I'm curious, like, what kind of reactions, if any, from showing this music or this music reaching older ears, given the combination of Yiddish and electronic music?
Well, the first thing I want to say is that electronic music has now been around for half a century, and so a lot of people are really well-versed and used to it, and I've been spending some time in Detroit, which is the birthplace of techno music, and the traditions that I play from. And there is a similar generational system set up there as the one with Yiddishists in New York. And so there's the older generation, the younger generation, everyone has different communications. So there are older people who are techno practitioners who are also listening to this, and they've never heard Yiddish before, but they're listening from a techno perspective. But to answer your question in the way that you meant it, the older Yiddish people who are listening to this have varying reactions. Many of them are very moved to hear these old recordings, to hear them in a variety of spaces, to hear recordings that some of them have never heard before, because I'm working very closely with these archives to make sure that these never before heard recordings are circulating. And I think people are getting into it. I've been sort of going back and forth with my friend Avia Moore, who's a Yiddish dance leader, about what it would mean to dance in a Yiddish way to this music, and sort of figuring out together. And many of these older people are used to these traditional dances, and so incorporating that into the performances has been really interesting and fun. And I think that everyone within Yiddish music as a whole, for all the entire course of history, has been making new and sometimes culturally dissonant things with the music. And that is a tradition that I'm proud to be a part of. But I want to say, as a footnote, Coda, especially the Klezmer Revival, my mentor, Hank Osnetsky, who was very influential in the Klezmer Revival, used the New England Conservatory, where I went to school, as an institution to bring students through and into this revival. He had klezmer bands as part of the school, and he worked out of this sort of experimental contemporary music program within the school, which gave the Klezmer Revival a kind of experimental music character in the tradition of free jazz and contemporary improvised music that I think is really interesting to. It opened the possibilities for this and this music. And Hankus has been very instrumental in helping me work with these recordings and set them and figure out what are traditional ways to set them within electronic modalities. Cool. There you go.
Ben's gonna make an announcement. So if you wanna like continue and learn more and engage more around this like Marxist, secular, Jewish meets spiritual, religious Jewish space,
Yeah,
we have an event
saying,
coming up.
Thank you for announcing my announcement.
Yeah.
As Chell
like
was saying, arguably one of the more radical things is to bridge this like historically very anti-religious part of the anarchist Marxist Judaism, Jewishness, Yiddishkeit, with this more observant, ritually based Judaism. And one thing that we're doing with the Tzim Tzum Collective community this year is we're actually doing something called a Yom Kippur Ball, which I feel like Chaya might be familiar with.
You're
not sure.
No way.
Well, the Yom Kippur Ball is something that was held initially in London in 1888 by Jewish anarchists. And the idea was, right as the fast was supposed to start, rather than fasting and being sad and reflective, the idea was to have Jewish joy, to have a massive banquet and feast and celebration and explicitly say, there is no God, or fuck you, God. And
okay.
That being said, we're doing a variation on that, where rather than being explicitly anti-religion, we are going to be doing the traditional Kol Nidre blessing. We're going to be starting it before the fast traditionally starts, so that those who would like to fast don't need to be necessarily alienated from it. And that's going to be on Kol Nidre on October 1st, and we're going to be doing it as effectively like a curated open mic. We're asking people to sign up in advance to do songs, stand-up comedy, I don't know, maybe a skit. It could be anything, as well as a potluck. We really want to create this space for radical Jewish joy, because it's something that really, I mean, the fact that Chaya hasn't even heard of a Yom Kippur ball is just shows that this tradition's been lost. And it's something that's so incredibly exciting to bring back. So October 1st, if you don't have Kol Nidre plans, please join us at the Resource Center for Nonviolence.
And you
it's
have to register ahead of
time.
Very
exciting.
Great.
Not sure if I should have said the location.
Resource Center for Nonviolence, but you have to register.
Yes, and ask me or Chell about registration
we'll
if you're interested.
Sure.
Oh, I'm going to make also an announcement. If you happen to be in the East Bay tomorrow, I'm giving a talk about Sounds of the High Holidays from these Yiddish archival recordings. And because of the announcement you just made, maybe I'll incorporate some of this anti-fasting traditions, sort of from my usual radical perspective, a talk about samples of the High Holidays with techno. And I'm going to have an overhead camera that shows my hands, so if you can't see them tonight, come to the East Bay tomorrow. It's at Kehila Community Synagogue, and you can you can look up the event on kehilasynagogue.org. So come through tomorrow if you like today.
Yay!
Okay.
Thank you.